You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Issa Rae on the cover. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's this month's editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief. In the photo, the digital cover of the special section on awards-worthy TV, with Gillian Anderson on that cover. I was a few episodes into Ted Lasso before I noticed the title character's habit of tossing off a sotto voce, "I appreciate you," whenever he had a baseline positive interaction with someone. Ted, an American football coach played by Jason Sudeikis, has come to England to coach a soccer team. He is purposely set up to fail in every possible way, heckled relentlessly by the press, the fans, and often his own players. No one appreciates him. "And yet, I appreciate you," he says, over and over, in response to even a minuscule act of kindness. His team isn't winning, but Ted is, just by appreciating people. By the time the team starts to score, the show had decisively won me over, and now part of my July is booked to binge the second season, right after I'm done with the second season of Never Have I Ever. Maitreya Ramakrishnan, I appreciate you. It has been a year of superlative TV, and with this issue we dive headlong into appreciating it. We appreciate Issa Rae, legend in her own time, who at 36 has ascended to the status of bona fide TV mogul as she wraps her immensely successful series Insecure and looks to the future. We're addicted to a slew of magnificent shows from beyond our national borders, because if we can't be tourists at the Louvre during a pandemic, at least we can watch Omar Sy as Lupin pull off a magisterial heist there. We bow to the imaginative power of the location scouts of The Flight Attendant, the transformative hair and makeup designer of I May Destroy You, the maestro behind the period crossover musical arrangements of Bridgerton. I am personally inspired by the elocution tip Gillian Anderson reveals from her scene-stealing portrayal of Margaret Thatcher in The Crown, that taking a breath in the middle of a sentence decreases the possibility that you'll be cut off at the end of it. We've loved Catherine Hahn all along, haven't you? We also know that the great TV of the present comes on the shoulders of great TV of the past. The cast and crew of A Different World come together to reminisce about the boundary-breaking show that changed their lives and influenced a generation of actors and viewers alike. And Norman Lear, the iconic creator of All in the Family, Sanford and Son, The Jeffersons, Good Times, and more classics of the medium, answers the Proust questionnaire for the first time as he looks forward to his 99th birthday this summer. He responds to the question, "What is your favorite occupation?" with one simple word, "Laughing." Now that we really appreciate. Thank you. Here are some of the contributors to this issue. Abigail Tracy, White Flight. While reporting on the so-called Memphis Patriots, Tracy, a staff writer, called ringleader John Dobbs. "He didn't hang up the phone after the conversation," says Tracy. "I overheard him talking about Vanity Fair and myself to the people he was with. The last thing I want to do is talk to them." Joshua Hunt, the missing Magritte. Hunt was in Belgium interviewing the federal prosecutor for a book project when the conversation strayed to a Magritte heist. "I let him keep talking because what he told me was so compelling," says Hunt. "A story about stolen art, terrorist plots, and above all, a missed opportunity to avert one of the decade's great tragedies." Joyce Maynard, Shame the Devil. Joyce Maynard, who lived with J.D. Salinger as a young woman, was left unsettled by HBO's Allen vs. Farrow documentary. The kind of dismissal and humiliation Woody Allen supporters employed, attempting to discredit Mia Farrow, offered a chillingly familiar reminder of what I had experienced, says the author of the forthcoming novel, Count the Ways. Amy Wallace, Catherine Hahn All Along. Wallace admits that the job of a profile writer has gotten harder during the pandemic. "Zoom is better than nothing, but it can be hard to get a genuine glimpse of the person on the other end of the laptop," says Wallace, who interviewed Catherine Hahn for the issue. She was hip to this and seemed eager to be truly known. Wallace adds, "What most struck me about Catherine was her warmth." Adrienne Raquel, Ray of Light. For Issa Rae's first Vanity Fair cover, Raquel photographed her at a legendary Los Angeles location, the Sheets Goldstein residence. "It was a major moment," says Raquel. "I've admired Issa for quite some time, and I love how she continues to be a trailblazer throughout Hollywood." Casey Wilson, For the Love of Real Housewives. "I'm done being a garbage TV apologist," says Wilson, an actor and writer whose new essay collection, The Wreckage of My Presence, is excerpted this month. "Watching Housewives has been a form of self-care for me this past year, and I wanted to write a love-hate letter to my favorite frenemies." Shiona Torini, Ray of Light. The costume designer on Issa Rae's Insecure, Torini was inspired to dress the actress in a new light for Vanity Fair, and not as her character, who has such a defined aesthetic. "For this cover, I wanted to show the difference between Issa D and Issa Rae," says Torini. "She is a force on camera, but we really got to explore the powerhouse that Issa Rae has become off-screen as well." Tom Craig, Scene Stealers. Craig, a photographer based in London, worked with rain and smoke machines, live doves, ball pits, and even a large fluffy cat on set. "When planning the shoot, I felt strongly that I wanted to tap into the classic heritage of Vanity Fair, but with all the fun that we have been craving during lockdown," says Craig, "it was like post-pandemic pagan magic." Zohar Lazar, White Flight. The boll weevil was the perfect mascot for a privileged class that so blithely celebrates a shameful chapter in our nation's history, says Lazar, who illustrated wealthy Trump supporters traveling by private jet to January Stop the Steal rally. Johanna Desta, Ray of Light. Before she was assigned this month's cover story, Desta, a staff writer, had already interviewed Issa Rae several times throughout the actor's rise. "She's the same as she ever was, quick-witted, kind, engaging, low-key," says Desta. "Even though her career has skyrocketed and she's worlds more famous than she was 5 years ago, she's still deeply grounded." Here's what's trending. Polo Lounge. Whether it's the country club or Pinkies Up Tea this summer, stick to the strictures of the official Preppy Handbook and Carlton Banks. Classic cuts and bold prints with a delightfully restrained touch of 60s pop. In the photo, the formidable Carlton Banks dancing to the beat of his own Tom Jones on the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. To the nines, in the photos, Tory Burch swimsuit in checks, Sophie Bilbra necklace, and that is a classic strand of fake pearls. Polo Lauren, Polo Ralph Lauren vest, that is, in a classic print, Tata Harper Superkind softening cleanser, Jennifer Bayer headband in green velvet, Gucci polo, Dior dress in pink plaid, Salvatore Ferragamo bag in solid pink, Chanel Bleu de Chanel shaving kit, Blackstock and Weber loafer in a two-tone tan and white, and Lacoste polo shirt with the classic alligator emblem in yellow and white horizontal stripes. And that's what's trending at the Polo Preppy Lounge. From the gallery, La Vie Boheme by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Daniel Gordon. In the photograph are two classic pineapple-shaped leather-woven handbags. For the past 4 years, Loewy designer Jonathan Anderson has channeled the easy vibes of Paula's, a boutique in Ibiza that flourished in the 70s and 80s, into a summertime collaboration with Paula's founder, Armin Heinemann. It captures my idea of escapism, says Anderson, who grew up visiting the island Bohemia. This year's capsule features a hippie chic caftan, a moon print sweatsuit, and these juicy confections. The woven leather crossbody bags, shaped like strawberries and pineapples, plus a nifty sliced passion fruit coin purse, evoke warm climes and carefree living. Salud. Stay louche. The collective desire to slip into party mode, stoked by newfound freedom and Halston, puts eyeshadow back into play by Laura Regensdorf. Months of daydreaming about the social scene's return has set the agenda ahead. Never-ending evenings with cool drinks and perfect strangers. More glamour than effort. If that calls to mind 70s-era Angelica Houston in a plunging halter and lavender eyeshadow, Netflix's 5-episode Halston arrives to second that mood. The designer circle of friends and models, including Elsa Peretti and Pat Cleveland, pulled off slinky elegance with ease. A worthwhile lodestar for summer beauty. Eyeshadow is going to have this kind of revolution, says Sam Visser, makeup artist ambassador for Dior, of the need for expressive color after an underdressed year. The 21-year-old is a master of the medium, as seen in retro-futuristic looks on Bella Hadid and Nadja Lee Cohen. But his directive right now is no-fuss monochrome, made simple with Dior's velvety new mono shadows. There's no time to labor in the mirror, says Visser. We're rushing to get out. In the photos, Halston amid his muses in 1972, including Angelica Houston in a yellow caftan, Beverly Johnson in pastel Halston, 1975, Dior Show Monocouleur Couture Eyeshadow in Tutu Pink Coral and Denim. Summer Lovin', the new essentials are all about low-key polish, and with the Sex and the City reboot now in motion, these three are fit for on-screen cameos. Yes, a scrunchy, even Carrie could wear. Do everything lip. Whatever the agenda, lunch meeting or makeout, the hybrid ultra lip formula is a go. Seed oils, watermelon, meadow foam, and hyaluronic acid give a plush balm texture. The nine tints wear like an understated grown-up gloss. All-purpose trimmer. With the past year remapping relationships to body hair, Furs Trimmer is a well-timed addition. All gender, all terrain. Cordless and water-resistant, it offers four lengths. Neoclassical grooves lend grip, and an LED at the tip lights the way. Elevated Classic. The fanciful scrunchies on Celine's Spring 2021 runway are for a new generation. It's not a full carbon copy. They've made it their own, says the show's hairstylist, Esther Langham. It's all about ease now, from wrist to eye candy ponytail. And Caitlin Brody gives us this first look, Teen Spirit. On the set of Gossip Girl with Eric Demon, the show's longtime costume designer. Tights are not pants. Leighton Meester's Blair Waldorf famously shrieked during the second season of Gossip Girl. The series, which ended its six-season run in 2012, is back this July on HBO Max, with a new cast gracing the steps of the Met. And now, according to Eric Demon, who has held dominion over the show's iconic aesthetic since the first season, tights are pants. Athleisure has become fused into the system. For the more than 200 costumes per episode, he looked to influencers, the Hadid sisters, Kaia Gerber, and the streets of his own East Village neighborhood. Think oversized proportions, like extra, extra large jackets paired with itty-bitty biker shorts. Super contemporary. And while longtime fans should be on the lookout for fashion Easter eggs, the headband has been retired, he says, at least for the moment. In the photos, costume designer Eric Demon sporting a custom Constance Billard varsity jacket, dressing Thomas Doherty, who plays Max Wolfe. I really dive into the characters and peel them back like an onion. I look at how they've been brought up, what they've been exposed to. In the 2007 pilot, Serena wore a tan jacket, a striped shirt, and a handkerchief around her neck. We nodded to that with Kate, played by Tavi Gevinson. Someone posted a side-by-side on social media. We used to have to wait for people to run a picture a month later. A J.W. Anderson midi cap bag from the wardrobe department stash. Julian Calloway, played by Jordan Alexander. Julian's dad is a music producer, so I referenced early Rihanna for a fantastic mashup of the early aughts music world with the influencer Instagram world. Keziah Weir writes on books, novel ideas, a wealth of new books from wry satires to stormy thrillers are getting TV treatments with big stars attached. Illustration by Agata Nowicka, showing Julia Roberts, Lupita Nyong'o, Natalie Portman, and Mindy Kaling, who are all attached to forthcoming series adaptations. In 2011, George R.R. Martin told the New York Times that he published Game of Thrones after a decade of Hollywood turning down his drafts due to their length and projected expense. The irony of all this is that the project I thought most unlikely to ever be filmed, he said, is now going to be this big show on HBO. There were books to TV adaptations long before the dawn of Westeros, from the Foresight saga to Friday Night Lights. But the rise of streaming and an insatiable thirst for market-tested IP has produced a bumper crop of recent hits based on bestsellers. Big Little Lies, Normal People, A Handmaid's Tale. This year has already heralded adaptation announcements for Taffy Broadisser Eckner's Fleischman is in Trouble and Laura Lippman's Lady in the Lake, both 2019 publishing successes. FX's Fleischman has, as of press time, yet to be cast, while Apple TV Plus has tapped Lupita Nyong'o and Natalie Portman for Lippman's Baltimore-set thriller. Other books, page-turners that speak to universal emotional concerns, have been snapped up before they're even available to readers. Mindy Kaling's Kaling International is adapting Sanjena Sathian's Gold Diggers, which came out from Penguin Press in April, for Warner Brothers. The satire kicks off in the Indian-American community of an Atlanta suburb with an elixir that turns gold into drinkable ambition. Elsewhere on Apple TV+, Julia Roberts' Red Films in collaboration with Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine is taking on Laura Dave's The Last Thing He Told Me, out in May from Simon & Schuster, in which a woman attempts to track down her missing husband, reluctant stepdaughter in tow. Roberts will star, and Dave and her husband, screenwriter Josh Singer, whose credits include Spotlight, are co-writing. It's been a special experience to think about love and marriage and family alongside the person I get to share these things with, she says. And as Zakiya Dalila Harris publishes her debut, The Other Black Girl, published by Atria, this month, she will already be hard at work adapting the novel for Hulu. With the episodic nature of TV, I have to be a lot more mindful of time and pacing. Tara Duncan, the exec who acquired the project, was drawn to the book because it so cleverly and hilariously uses the thriller genre to encapsulate the psychological warfare of office politics, she says. Even if you're not familiar with dog whistle racial microaggressions, anyone who's had a boss, anyone who's had a job, knows a tone-deaf boss, clicky co-workers, and the mental pressure of trying to find your authentic voice. Laugh track. Gina Yashir, a creator of CBS's Bob Hearts Abishola, daughter of Nigerian immigrants and author of the new memoir, Cack-Handed, shares her inspirations with a caveat. I was a child of the 80s in England. Blackish. I love watching a family being unapologetically black, tackling issues that pertain to us, and delving in through humor and on primetime TV. Different strokes. A bit problematic, but as a kid, my dream was to be adopted by a rich old man and have a white maid. As I said, child of the 80s, England. Born a Crime by Trevor Noah. We had similar experiences, though born in different countries. I loved his journey and storytelling style, and his mom was almost as nuts as mine. Thank you. never say never. Maitreya Ramakrishnan went from study halls to Netflix stardom practically overnight. By Brett Hinemuth and photographed by Tierney Giron. Maitreya Ramakrishnan was a 12th grader starring in a teen production of Chicago when Mindy Kaling began searching for a young South Asian woman to lead her precocious Netflix dramedy Never Have I Ever. Her winning audition beat the 15,000 others who tried out for Devi, a part that earned Ramakrishnan a spot on A.O. Scott's list of 2020's best performances and a Time 100 anointment. Now the 19-year-old is bracing for season two and trying to maintain perspective. I kept putting the pressure on myself to represent brown girls everywhere, and I was like, hold on, if I'm not going to put that pressure on a fictional character, why the hell would I do that to myself? Her childhood home in Mississauga was filled with big personalities. Ramakrishnan's musically inclined brother, labor relations specialist mother, government worker father, maternal grandmother, and dog, Melody. Everyone is so dramatic. We definitely dish it to each other. You enter our household, and we're going to make you feel like family, but I can't protect you. Her parents both left their native country of Sri Lanka during the Tamil genocide. Like many immigrant stories, it's never a linear line. My mom traveled all around the world from Dubai to England. My dad went to South Africa, then Montreal, before meeting my mom in Ontario. When she saw Kaling's tweet, she and her best friend recorded each other's auditions at their local library. I still have the text conversation. Imagine if we went to Hollywood. We could totally be Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. She dreams of playing a princess, maybe Princess Diana, in a period piece. Her fan base is wide-ranging, from a 7-year-old girl at a cafe to a grown woman bursting into tears. I think the show is what their inner child really yearned for. As for that second season, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I think season two is better than season one. You're going to scream at Devi, but you're also going to want to hug her. Be Kind, Rewind. On her third album, Home Video, Lucy Dacus filters growing pains into balm-like melodies. Hear the stories behind three songs. Raised in Mechanicsville, Virginia, Dacus modeled Brando on a friend who acted as her cultural tutor, showing her films like A Streetcar Named Desire. His personality was just an amalgamation of all these movies, an imitation. Brief notes on staying. An essay in Hanif Abdulkarib's 2017 book, inspired Please Stay, Phoebe Bridgers and Julian Baker lend vocals on the track. It's about losing people and being exhausted, but needing to find a way to get through life. An early crush shaped VBS. I was totally infatuated with this kid who loved heavy bands. He had a tough home life and would blast Slayer to get to sleep. It had a calming effect on him. For the love of Real Housewives, I have watched these women not grow and not change for 15 years. It's been glorious, by Casey Wilson. Opening illustration of the cast by Tim McDonough. I discovered the franchise that would become the love of my life during the darkest period of my life. My mom had passed away suddenly, and I was back in Los Angeles, a city I now loathed due to its relentless sunlight. I spent my days lying on a stained couch in my apartment on Cahuenga Boulevard, Cross Street, the mouth of the 101 freeway. I lived with my dear pal from college, Laura, and our place was a shithole. When we'd looked at the color wheel at Home Depot, the only color we could agree on for our common space was green. Within the green family, the only shade we could agree on was bright stoplight green, which we used only half-heartedly to cover the walls, because no two lazier people have ever existed. While friends hated it aesthetically, several people rented it to shoot projects that required a green screen. They say after a loved one dies, it's important not just to stay alive, but to thrive. Lying on that couch and watching garbage programming was how I spent my early days of mourning. The only errand I actually completed was one I reasoned was worth the effort because it would help lower future exertion levels. I visited my OBGYN to ask for a prescription for something I'd read about online, pee pills. What are those, you ask? They're capsules designed to mask your body's urges to urinate, so you pee less frequently. Grief had me in such a state of lethargy, I felt genuinely fed up with expending even the energy required to go to the bathroom. My doctor was a bit thrown by my request. She told me they're usually only prescribed for the elderly and infirm, and in some cases, here in Los Angeles, to agents' assistants who aren't allowed to leave their desk during the day. I told her I didn't have a desk, but I had a couch and didn't want to leave it. It was under these grim conditions, remote control in hand, that I came across two lifelines. One was a network called Bravo. The other was its new reality show, The Real Housewives of Orange County. It featured rich older gals who lived in a tiny hamlet I had never heard of, but now have engraved on an anklet charm called Cota de Casa. As fate would have it, I was one of the lucky ones who stumbled across the first airing of the first episode. I had met the women who would become my lifelong frenemies, the first of whom was the OG of the OC, Vicky Whoop-It-Up Gunvalson, a delightfully unhinged blonde insurance agent burdened with an anger problem that eclipsed even mine. I watched the first episodes with my mouth open. Each woman was like an emptied-out purse, the detritus of her life strewn about for all to see. I hated them, but I also liked them, nay, rooted for them. And then Bravo went and added another city, and another, and another, and new disasters of humans were revealed. They say there are no great parts for women over 40. I beg to differ. These women are as Medea-esque in their emotional tenor as they are tiny in their emotional intelligence. Betty Davis never summoned the rage Dorinda Medley gave us after hosting the other housewives for a weekend in her Berkshire's home that ended in ruin when she threatened them with an empty wine bottle. Hands shaking, eyes wet with tears, slur yelling at the top of her lungs, "I decorated, I cooked, I made it nice." As far as fans go, the older the housewife, the better. We are wary and often resentful when they introduce younger blood. Those young upstarts can get the F out with their zero experience of throwing wine in someone's face during a fall bash, and no precedent of standing by as a friend's 70-year-old husband gets pushed onto the Baja shelf of a Beverly Hills pool, almost paralyzing him for life. No, this franchise has no place for a wide-eyed ingenue just off the bus with a tube of chapstick and a dream. I want my housewives just out of a repossessed Lamborghini with a tube top and a broken dream. I've spent hundreds of nights watching these women not change and not grow up, like an effed up The Truman Show. My husband can't stand the sound of them screaming. "Really?" I say, genuinely shocked. See, for me, their screams are like waves crashing upon the shore. I look forward to being lulled to sleep by the wails of a woman drinking tequila in Mexico who just stabbed herself in the hand with a steak knife. I love drifting off to the sweet sounds of Kenya Moore or Ramona Singer ranting and raving. What exactly are they ranting and raving about? It doesn't matter. It just feels like home. And that home is the house that Andy built. Andy Cohen is the longtime impresario of the Real Housewives franchise, our Warholian godfather. He knows he need only stand back and let these women live out loud. But he's also not afraid to step in and cut even the strongest team member, lest anyone think the show hinges on them. Andy's greatest strength, however, is knowing that above all else, the shows are funny. During a mid-pandemic Zoom reunion, the Lucille Ball of the franchise, Portia Williams, told a fellow castmate whose breasts weren't looking their best, "Girl, them titties is aged hens. They social distancing." Chef's kiss. In an iconic moment during a Beverly Hills reunion, Kim Richards returned a stuffed bunny, still wrapped in plastic, that Lisa Rinna had given her daughter, because, I quote, "Kim didn't feel like it was given to me with the right energy." Andy watched with restrained glee as Lisa, in turn, delivered a soap opera-worthy single tear, complete with quivering lip, then slow walked off the set to collect himself. Though we may laugh, we must also learn from these desperate unicorns. They are the ghost of Christmas future. They've selflessly taught us what not to do, like pretending you own a ski chalet and have multiple personal assistants, when in fact one of the assistants may be aiding you with a telemarketing scheme, which the feds recently arrested you for, while, prepare yourself for the three greatest words a housewives fan could hear, cameras were rolling. But while we get to turn them off and go on our merry, it is Andy who bears the brunt of their wrath when things don't go their way. He was shoved by Teresa Giudice during a reunion, but that didn't stop him from later sitting across from her and conducting a meaningful one-on-one Diane Sawyer style. I tuned in for it like it was the moon landing. While many of my friends watched the franchise, one of them spoke the language most fluently. Her name was Danielle Schneider, and I knew her as an unbelievably sweet and hilarious writer-actor from the Upright Citizens Brigade. When our pal Paul Scheer suggested we do a podcast devoted to our obsession, it struck us as a bit déclassé. Do a podcast about reality TV? We were artistes. But after giving it 2 minutes of hard thought, we decided that, while we would probably just be screaming into the void, it would be fun to get some hot takes to the people. Danielle suggested we call it Bitch Sesh, and we set up mics in my breakfast nook and started talking. At this time, I was struggling after the birth of my first son. It was like someone had taken a dustbuster to my hormones. All at once, I felt more joy than I ever had, alongside waves of crushing depression. This podcast, devoted to nonsense, ended up being such a lift for my spirits, and not just mine. A community was born around it. I hope I speak for all Bitch Sesh fans when I say we're no longer housewives apologists. Michelle Obama is a fan of Atlanta, and there was a time when President Barack Obama followed Jen from New Jersey on Twitter. I will no longer feel shame over a pleasure I don't feel to be a guilty one. Life is hard. This is our nerd culture, our sports. I may laugh when the housewives lose, but I cry when they win. When Mike Hill asked Cynthia to marry him, when Portia stepped into her true calling as an activist seeking justice for Breonna Taylor, when Erica won the role of Roxy Hart in Chicago and cried with the aged husband she is now in a bitter divorce battle with, when Luann completed her probation, when Shannon got over David's betrayal and started her own frozen foods line, and when I found out that Vicky, the original housewife I watched from my couch on Cahuenga Boulevard, was retiring after 14 seasons, I wept on the beach, two margaritas in. Vicky is a truly despicable person, but I have a soft spot for her. For all of them, they have been entertaining me for 15 years, and even though they don't know me, I have borne witness to the breadth of their lives. I've been there for them, and make no mistake, they've been there for me, too. Excerpted from The Wreckage of My Presence, Essays by Casey Wilson, copyright 2021, by Casey Wilson, used by arrangement with HarperCollins. All rights reserved. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Opening and closing music for this program by Calexico, Interval Selections, by Mark Hoffman.